Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Night Wanderer of an Afghan Fort, from Blackwoods Magazine. That evening, the last of my visit, I remained sleepless for many hours after throwing myself upon my bed. My mind was occupied in revolving the strange occurrences of the two past nights. The more I reflected, the more puzzled and mystified did I become. With a spectral apparition, for I had almost begun to look upon it as such, I could in no way connect the bodily presence of the old Uzir, for it was his visit to the ruined building adjacent of which I had been a silent witness that made me suspect he was in some way or other connected with a silent midnight watcher that had attracted my attention during that first night. But on the occurrences of the following night, I could form no conjecture whatever. It was preposterous to suppose that a man well stricken in years, as he was, could have attempted, much less succeeded, in making an exit from the window situated as mine was, and that the thing, whatever it was, had made its egress from the window, I felt convinced. Besides, what object could he have had in visiting the stealthily and by night the chamber occupied by me? The idea that he had come for the purpose and with the design of taking anything from me by stealth, I could not for a moment entertain. For in the first place, there was nothing that I had that he would be likely to covet, and in the second, such conduct on his part would have been a breach of those laws of hospitality which an Afghan, in his position, would be the last to hold in light esteem. Looking at the matter in every light that occurred to me, I was utterly unable to arrive at any satisfactory solution of that which was in so bewildering a degree puzzling and mystifying me. And thinking over, in its minutest details, all that I had seen, I began, as the silent hours of night went by, to entertain a sort of dread presentiment that I was destined again to witness something on this, the last night of my stay, that would startle and appall me. Such a fixed idea in my brain did this become that it really brought a sort of fascination with it, a feeling of dread expectancy that quite banished all desire and inclination for sleep. I was now determined that I would keep awake throughout the night in order that if by chance anything should approach, I would, being on the alert, in all probability be able to form some sort of conjecture as to its nature and design. Restless and disturbed in consequence of the feeling that had gradually come over me, I could remain no longer in my bed. I therefore arose and seated myself in observation behind the window that looked into the terrace. Though in this position I was entirely concealed from the view of anyone approaching by the terrace, I could see into it as far as the darkness of the night permitted, and I could also see the window which, if any visitor of the night previous did not partake of a supernatural or ghostly character, must, I concluded, have means of access to it of which I was entirely ignorant. From the position of the constellation Orion, I judged that it was close upon midnight when I took my seat by the window. The moon had not yet risen, so that the terrace beneath was in pitchy darkness, save in one spot. Here the remains of a fire which the servants had built up with sticks and straw under the wall still glowed and flickered as every now and then a breath of the night wind blew it into life. I had not been in my post of observation long when a large rat scampered up to within the light by the embers. He approached them cautiously and with apparently satisfied after solemn scrutiny that there was no immediate danger to be apprehended. He commenced to eat voraciously the crumbs and relics that remained on the ground from the evening meal. These disposed of, he concentrated an attack of teeth and claws upon a half-burnt candle that had been left by the servants. I was watching his every movement with intense interest when the surrounding stillness was scattered by a sudden noise. It seemed to come from the other side of the wall of the terrace, and was as that of a person on the move, but of one who rather ran than walked, for it was no measured tread, and that the footfall was not distinguishable. The sound ceased, and then all was again still. It was no mere fancy, my having heard the sounds, for I observed that the rat suddenly ceased his nibbling and stared at the wall, as if he expected that it was about to open and something emerge from it. The sounds came from the further side, ceasing. My friend, the rat, commenced at the candle again, as if he, assured by the silence which had ensued, that there was no immediate danger to be apprehended. But the silence was not of long duration, for after only a few minutes it was broken by the noise as of some heavy body dropping into the terrace, and upon my side of the wall. Of this, from the sound, there was not the least doubt. Then followed the noise of the shuffling quick movements that I had heard before. That something was approaching was evident, for the rat jerked his head in the direction of the noise, sharply whisked his tail in the other, then incontinently vanished. I peered into the darkness, endeavoring in vain to discern what it was that was moving on the terrace. But nothing was visible for a few seconds. Then, as the sounds approached the fire, I saw gliding forth from the gloom into the light a tall, draped, and phantom-shaped figure. It resembled in such a startling manner that which had almost pictured itself in my imagination as the thing that I was destined to see, that I felt appalled and horror-struck, thinking that the figure was nothing more or less than a sheeted ghost. I thought I would hail it, but my tongue clave to my mouth, and I felt utterly unable to speak or move. As it approached the embers, a tongue of flame leaped upwards from the outlying fragments of stick and straw, and flickering for a moment in the night breeze, threw a sudden gleam around. Noticing this, it was with a shuddering recollection I remembered the lone creature from the wood in Coleridge's Christabel, at whose weird presence the dying embers in the old ancestral hall burst into flame, and the dogs howled as in abject dread. An indescribable horror of the mysterious apparition that was now within a few feet of where I was concealed crept over me. Yet, feeling this horror with the greatest intensity, I had no inclination to take my eyes away from the dreaded object, for now its every movement had a strange fascination for me. What was my astonishment to see it, as it approached the fire, stoop down and put forth a long, lean, nervous hand to clutch the candle. This was held over the embers, and then above them, and lighted by their glow, I saw what looked to me like the pale, distended cheeks of a human face, distended with the act of blowing. The candle suddenly flared into flame, and I then saw, but gracious heavens, how shall my poor pen convey an idea of the strange being that was now seating itself by the fire? The face, illuminated by the fitful glare of a candle, was evidently that of a woman, but the features were so sharply defined, there was such strange hard lines about the mouth and brow, that there was nothing soft or womanly in its expression. And then there was a look in the eyes which was terrible, large, prominent, and reflecting the glow of the embers. They seemed to be lit by the fire that you see in the house of a wild animal. They rolled incessantly in their sockets, except when every now and then the strange creature, apparently listening attentively, turned them with a fixed stare full upon the window behind which I was ensconced, as if she were trying to pierce the gloom of the chamber. Then, as the brows contracted, and as the white of the eyes grew painfully visible, there was something dreadful in her aspect. It was a frenzied concentration of baffled hate, revenge, and despair, and as I looked upon the ghastly paleness of the face, relieved by the black mass of disheveled hair falling on one shoulder, it seemed as if a portrait as terrible as that of Leonardo da Vinci's Medusa had framed itself in the immeasurable gloom of night in front of me. As she seated herself by the fire, the loose white drapery which had enveloped a person, had fallen not ungracefully around her. Her arms, stretched out towards the heat of the embers, were long and sinewy, and the muscles resembled, in their hard, wiry look, more those of one of the species of the large Quadrumana than those of a human being. Looking at them and her lithe, quick movements, it was evident that she was possessed of amazing agility and physical strength. My eye took in these details patiently enough when once, after the first momentary glance, I assured myself that this nightly visitor of mine was a human being, and not some phantom from another world. But her strange and at times incoherent gestures, and the wild, restless look in her eyes, had convinced me that she was a maniac. The melancholy state of the poor creature's mind was only too clearly and too painfully manifest, as from her attentive listening, with head bent in the direction of my room, I was sure that she did not wish to attract my attention or be seen by me. I remained perfectly still. She had remained some minutes seated when the candle, which she had fixed cleverly enough on end upon the terrace, seemed to rivet her attention. She was evidently pleased at the light that it gave, for a satisfied look passed across her features as she watched the flame bend hither and thither in the night wind. Suddenly she rose and sped swiftly away to the door that led into the terrace. I at first fancied that she was gone, for I heard her undo the fastenings of the door on the inside. But this was no sooner done than she made good her way to the spot where my baggage had been placed. She turned over several of the articles, and then came back to the fire with swiftly stealthy tread. I observed that she had brought with her 3 candles, the last in my possession, and lighting these she appeared to have filled the measure of her contentment. A low, satisfied laugh came from her half-closed lips. The evil expression of her features vanished, and there came upon them a gleam of forlorn beauty. Now that I could see her well, and in this mood, her likeness to Firmuse struck me forcibly. The same handsome cast of features, and the same bold, fearless look that his features bore at all times. She amused herself in childishly lighting and relighting the candles, and then secreting them one and all about her person. She rose as suddenly as she had done before. She stayed a second or two, listening attentively whether anything was moving in my chamber, and then, apparently satisfied, she flitted away in the direction of the door at the foot of the old ruined building. As I listened to her receding steps, as she strode through the deserted ruined passages, I heard the piercing, shrieking wail, which I now knew only too well. I now knew it to be her voice, the voice of this poor night-wandering maniac, and not the cry of the owl that thus rent the still midnight air. It was while riding down the gorge with Firmuse, for he, only attended by a few of his retainers, had accompanied me, that I determined to broach the subject that was on my mind. As it turned out, an opportunity happened sooner than I had expected, for in the course of conversation he, in his usual brusque way, asked me how I had slept during the 3 nights that I had been his father's guest. I related to him how I had been disturbed, and also what I had seen. I observed that in the course of my relation of the matter he was anxious, before answering any of my queries, to inform himself of all that I had seen, been a witness. Once informed by me to the full extent of this, he seemed to wish to have nothing further to conceal from me, and answered all my questions in his usual frank manner. Indeed, he did more, for he recounted to me the history of the poor creature whose wanderings by night had caused her to be seen by me. She was his only sister, but older than himself by several years. Her first husband, a cousin, and her playmate in childhood, into whom she was fondly attached, had been killed while yet a youth, and only a few months after their betrothal, in a foray with a rebellious tribe on the frontiers of Persia. She was then given in marriage by her father to the Ozir. It was shortly subsequent to this marriage that her reason became impaired, and though Firmuse did not assign any cause for this, I inferred from the few words that he said on this particular part of her history that it had been owing in a great measure to the Ozir's cruel treatment of her. His extreme jealousy and his cruel, savage disposition, which I had observed stamped with an unmistakable expression upon his features, had induced him to adopt measures for her confinement and seclusion, more stringent than those allowed and sanctioned by Mahometan law, even to the lord of the harem. She was maintained in so strict a solitude by him that not even one of her own sex was ever allowed to approach her. But as time grew on, her reason began to fail her, and then she would brook no confinement or imprisonment at his hands. She had made her escape from every place that the ingenuity of the Ozir had provided for her seclusion. At last, but reluctantly, he gave it up in despair as a hopeless task. For the last few years, she had been allowed perfect liberty of action. But having once exerted the whole force of her shaken reason in devising means of escape, and having invariably succeeded, her pleasure and custom now was to scale the lofty walls of the keep, and to make her way over its ruined and crumbling battlements by paths where no human foot dared follow her. She was never to be seen by daylight, but after dusk she was always on the move, and her wild shrieking wail would be wafted through the still air of night from the dizzy heights of the keep, deemed inaccessible by the Sirbus on guard, who listened in awe to her piercing cries. They had invested her with supernatural powers, and never dared look at her if she passed near their beat. Caulfield's Crime by Alice Perrin. Caulfield was a sulky, bad-tempered individual who made no friends and was deservedly unpopular, but he had the reputation of being the finest shot in the Punjab, and of possessing a knowledge of sporting matters that was almost superhuman. He was an extremely jealous shot, and hardly ever invited a companion to join him on his shooting trips, so it may be understood that I was keenly alive to the honor conferred on me when he suddenly asked me to go out for 3 days small game shooting with him. "I know a string of geels," he said, "about 30 miles from here, where the duck and snipe must swarm. I marked the place down when I was out last month, and I've made arrangements to go there next Friday morning. You can come too if you like." I readily accepted the ungracious invitation, though I could hardly account for it, knowing his solitary ways, except that he probably thought I was unlikely to assert myself, being but a youngster, and also he knew me better than he did most people, for our houses were next door, and I often strolled over to examine his enormous collection of skins and horns and other sporting trophies. I bragged about the coming expedition in the club that evening, and was well snubbed by two or three men who would have given anything to know the whereabouts of Caulfield's string of geels, and who spitefully warned me to be careful that Caulfield did not end by shooting me. "I believe he'd kill any chap who annoyed him," said one of them, looking round to make sure that Caulfield was not at hand. "I never met such a nasty-tempered fellow. I believe he's mad, but he can shoot, and what he doesn't know about game isn't worth knowing." Caulfield and I rode out 30 miles early on the Friday morning, having sent our camp on ahead the previous night. We found our tents pitched in the scanty shade of some stunted dark jungle trees, with thick, dry bark, flat, shapeless leaves that clattered together when stirred by the wind, and wicked-looking red blossoms. It was not a cheerful spot, and the soil was largely mixed with salt, which had worked its way in white patches to the surface, and only encouraged the growth of the rankest of grass. Before us stretched a dreary outlook of shallow lake and swampy ground, broken by dark patches of reeds and little bushy islands, while on the left a miserable mud village overlooked the water. The sun had barely cleared away the thick, heavy mist, which was still slowly rising here and there, and the geel birds were wading majestically in search of their breakfast of small fish, and uttering harsh, discordant cries. To my astonishment, Caulfield seemed a changed man. He was in excellent spirits. His eyes were bright, and the sullen frown had gone from his forehead. "Isn't it a lovely spot?" he said, laughing and rubbing his hands. "Beyond that village, the snipe ought to rise in thousands from the rice fields. We shan't be able to shoot it all in 3 days. Worse luck, but we'll keep it dark and come again. Let's have breakfast. I don't want to lose any time." Half an hour later we started, our guns over our shoulders, and a couple of servants behind us carrying the luncheon in cartridge bags. My spirits rose with Caulfield's, for I felt we had the certainty of an excellent day's sport before us. But the birds were unaccountably wild, and few and far between, and luck seemed dead against us. Some brutes had evidently been there before us and harried the birds, was Caulfield's opinion, delivered with disappointed rage. After tramping and waiting all day, we returned weary and crestfallen, with only a few couple of snipe and a half a dozen teal between us. Caulfield was so angry he could hardly eat any dinner, and afterwards sat cursing his luck and the culprits who had forestalled us, till we could neither of us keep awake any longer. The next morning we took a different route from the previous day, but with no better result. On and on, and round we tramped, with only an occasional shot here and there, and at last, long after midday, we sat wearily down to eat our luncheon. I was ravenously hungry and greedily devoured my share of the provisions, but Caulfield hardly touched a mouthful, and only sat moodily examining his gun, and taking long pulls from his whiskey flask. We were seated on the roots of a large tamarind tree, close to the village, and the place had a dreary, depressing appearance. The yellow mud walls were ruined and crumbling, and the inhabitants seemed scanty and poverty-stricken. Two ragged old women were squatting a short distance off, watching us with dim, apathetic eyes, and a few naked children were playing near them, while some bigger boys were driving two or three lean buffaloes towards the water. Presently another figure came in sight, a fakir, or mendicant priest, as was evident by the tawny masses of wool woven amongst his own black locks, and hanging in ropes below his shoulders, the ashes smeared over the almost naked body, and the hollow gourd for alms which he held in his hand. The man's face was long and thin, and his pointed teeth glistened in the sunlight as he demanded money in a dismal monotone. Caulfield flung a pebble at him and told him roughly to be off, with the result that the man slowly disappeared behind a clump of tall feathery grass. "Did you notice that brute's face?" said Caulfield, as we rose to start again. "He must have been a pariah dog in a former existence. He was exactly like one." "Or a jackal, perhaps," I answered carelessly. "He looks more like a wild beast." Then we walked on, skirting the village and plunging into the damp, soft rice fields. We put up a wisp of snipe, which we followed till we had shot them nearly all, and then, to our joy, we heard a rush of wings overhead, and a lot of duck went down into the corner of a geel in front of us. "We've got them," said Caulfield, and we hurried on till we were almost within shot of the birds and could hear them calling to each other in their fancied security. But suddenly they rose again in wild confusion, and with loud cries of alarm were out of range in a second. Caulfield swore, and so did I, and our rage was increased tenfold when the disturber of the birds appeared in sight and proved to be the fakir who had paid us a visit at luncheon time. Caulfield shook his fist at the man and abused him freely in Hindustani, but without moving a muscle of his dog-like face, the fakir passed on and continued on his way. Words could not describe Caulfield's vexation. "They were pintail, all of them," he said, "and the first decent chance we've had since we came out. To think of that beastly fakir spoiling the whole show, and I don't suppose he had the least idea what he had done." "Probably not," I replied, "unless there was some spite in it because you threw a stone at him that time." "Well, come along," said Caulfield, with resignation. "We must make haste, as it will be dark soon, and I want to try a place over by those palms before we knock off. We might as well let the servants go back, as they've had a hard day. Have you got some cartridges in your pocket?" "Yes, plenty," I answered, and after dispatching the two men back to camp with what little game we had got, we walked on in silence. The sun was sinking in a red ball, and the air was heavy with damp as the white mist stole slowly over the hill. Cold geels. Far ahead came the first faint crackle of the wild geese returning home for the night, and presently as we approached the clump of palms, we saw more water glistening between the rough stems, and on it, to our delight, a multitude of duck and teal. But the next moment there was a roof of wings like the rumble of thunder, and a dense mass of birds flew straight into the air and wheeled bodily away, while the sharp cold atmosphere resounded with their startled cries. Caulfield said nothing, but he set his jaw and walked rapidly forward while I followed. We skirted the group of palms, and on the other side we came upon our friend the fakir, who had again succeeded in spoiling our sport. The long, lanky figure was drawn to its full height, and white eyeballs and jagged teeth caught the red glint of the setting sun, and he waved his hand triumphantly in the direction of the vanishing cloud of birds. Then there came the loud report of a gun, and the next thing I saw was a quivering body on the ground, the wild eyes staring open in the agony of death. Caulfield had shot the fakir, and now he stood looking down at what he had done, while I knelt beside the body and tried hopelessly to persuade myself that life was not extinct. When I got up, we gazed at each other for a moment in silence. "What are we to do?" I asked presently. "Well, you know what it means," Caulfield said in a queer, hard voice. "Killing a native is no joke in these days, and I should come out of it pretty badly." I glanced at the body in horror. The face was rigid and seemed more beast-like than ever. I looked at Caulfield again before I spoke, hesitatingly. "Of course, the whole thing was unpremeditated, an accident." "No, it wasn't," he said defiantly. "I meant to shoot the brute, and it served him right, and you can't say anything else if it comes out. But I don't see why anyone should know about it but ourselves." "It's a nasty business," I said, my heart sinking at the suggestion of concealment. "It will be nastier still if we don't keep it dark, and you won't like having to give me away, you know. Either we must bury the thing here and say nothing about it, or else we must take it back to the station and stand the devil's own fuss. Probably I shall be kicked out of the service." "Of course I'll stand by you," I said with an effort, "but we can't do anything this minute. We'd better hide it in that long grass and come back after dinner. We must have something to dig with." Caulfield agreed sullenly, and between us we pushed the body in amongst the thick, coarse grass, which completely concealed it, and then made our way back to the camp. We ordered dinner and pretended to eat it, after which we sat for half an hour smoking, till the plates were cleared away and the servants had left the tent. Then I put my hunting knife into my pocket, and Caulfield picked up a kitchen chopper that his bearer had left lying on the floor, after hammering a stiff joint of a camp chair, and we quitted the tent casually, as though intending to have a stroll in the moonlight, which was almost as bright as day. We walked slowly at first, gradually increasing our pace as we left the camp behind us, and Caulfield never spoke a word until we came close to the tall grass that hid the fakir's body. Then he suddenly clutched my arm. "God in heaven," he whispered, pointing ahead. "What is that?" I saw the grass moving, and heard a scraping sound that made my heart stand still. We moved forward in desperation and parted the grass with our hand. A large jackal was lying on the fakir's body, grinning and snarling at being disturbed over his hideous meal. "Drive it away," said Caulfield hoarsely. But the brute refused to move, and as it lay there showing its teeth, its face reminded me horribly of the wretched man dead beneath its feet. I turned sick and faint, so Caulfield shouted and shook the grass and threw clods of soil at the animal, which rose at last and slunk slowly away. It was an unusually large jackal, more like a wolf, and had lost one of its ears. The coat was rough and mangy and thickly sprinkled with gray. More than an hour we worked desperately with a chopper and hunting knife, being greatly aided in our task by a rift in the ground, where the sod had been softened by water running from the geel, and finally we stood up with the sweat pouring from our faces and stamped down the earth, which now covered all traces of Caulfield's crime. We had filled the grave with some large stones that were lying about, remnants of some ancient temple long ago deserted and forgotten, thus feeling secure that it could not be easily disturbed by animals. The next morning we returned to the station, and Caulfield shut himself up more than ever. He entirely dropped his shooting, which before had been his one pleasure, and the only person he ever spoke to, unofficially, was myself. The end of April came with its plague of insects and scorching winds. The hours grew long and weary with the heat, and dust storms howled and swirled over the station, bringing perhaps a few tantalizing drops of rain, or more often leaving the air thick with a copper-colored haze. One night, when it was too hot to sleep, Caulfield suddenly appeared in my veranda and asked me to let him stay the night in my bungalow. "I know I'm an ass," he said in awkward apology, "but I can't stay by myself. I get all sorts of beastly ideas." I asked no questions, but gave him a cheroot and tried to cheer him up, telling him scraps of gossip and encouraging him to talk, when a sound outside made us both start. It proved to be only the weird, plaintive cry of a jackal, but Caulfield sprang to his feet, shaking all over. "There it is again," he exclaimed. "He has followed me over here. Listen," turning his haggard, sleepless eyes on me. "Every night, that brute comes and howls around my house, and I tell you, on my oath, it's the same jackal we saw eating the poor devil I shot." "Nonsense, my dear chap," I said, pushing him back into the chair. "You must have got fever. Jackals come and howl round my house all night. That's nothing." "Look here," said Caulfield, very calmly. "I have no more fever than you have. And if you imagine I'm delirious, you are mistaken." He lowered his voice. "I looked out one night and saw the brute. It had only one ear." In spite of my own common sense and the certainty that Caulfield was not himself, my blood ran cold, and after I had succeeded in quieting him, he dropped off to sleep on the couch. I sat in my long chair for hours, going over in my mind every detail of that horrible night in the jungle. Several times after this, Caulfield came to me and repeated the same tale. He swore he was being haunted by the jackal we had driven away from the fakir's body, and finally took it into his head that the spirit of the murdered man had injured the animal and was bent on obtaining vengeance. Then he suddenly ceased coming over to me, and when I went to see him, he would hardly speak, and only seemed anxious to get rid of me. I urged him to take leave or see a doctor, but he angrily refused to do either, and said he wished I would keep away from him altogether. So I left him alone for a couple of days, but on the third evening my conscience pricked me for having neglected him, and I was preparing to go over to his bungalow when his bearer rushed in with a face of terror and besought me to come without delay. He said he feared his master was dying, and he had already sent for the doctor. The latter arrived in Caulfield's veranda simultaneously with myself, and together we entered the sick man's room. Caulfield was lying unconscious on his bed. "He had a sort of fit, sahib," said the frightened bearer, and proceeded to explain how his master had behaved. The doctor bent over the bed. "Do you happen to know if he had been bitten by a dog lately?" he asked, looking up at me. "Not to my knowledge," I answered, while the faint wail of a jackal out across the plain struck a chill to my heart. For 24 hours we stayed with Caulfield, watching the terrible struggles we were powerless to relieve, and which lasted till the end came. He was never able to speak after the first paroxysm, which had occurred before we arrived, so we could not learn from him whether he had been bitten or not. Neither could the doctor discover any scar on his body, which might have been made by the teeth of an animal. Yet there was no shadow of a doubt that Caulfield's death was due to hydrophobia. We stood in the next room when all was over, drinking the dead man's whiskey and soda, which we badly needed. We questioned the bear closely, but he could tell us little or nothing. His master, he said, did not keep dogs, nor had the bearer ever heard of his having been bitten by one. But there had been a mad jackal about the place nearly 3 weeks ago, which his master had tried to shoot but failed. "It couldn't have been that," said the doctor. "He would have come to me if he had been bitten by a jackal." "No," I answered mechanically, "it could not have been that." I went into the bedroom to take a last look at poor Caulfield's thin white face with its ghastly hunted expression, for there was now nothing more that I could do for him. Then I picked up a lantern and stepped out into the dark veranda, intending to go home. As I did so, something came silently round the corner of the house and stood in my path. I raised my lantern and caught a glimpse of a mass of gray fur, two fiery yellow eyes and bared glistening teeth. It was only a stray jackal, and I struck at it with my stick, but instead of running away it slipped past me and entered Caulfield's room. The light fell on the animal's head, and I saw that I had only one ear. In a frenzy I rushed back into the house, calling for the doctor and servants. "I saw a jackal come in here," I said, searching round the bedroom. "Hunt it out at once." Every nook and corner was examined, but no jackal was found. "Go home to bed, my boy, and keep quiet till I come and see you in the morning," said the doctor, looking at me keenly. "This business has shaken your nerves, and your imagination is beginning to play you tricks. Good night." "Good night," I answered, and went slowly back to my bungalow, trying to persuade myself that he was right.